16.
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, councillors and visitors. Welcome to this, the Planning Control Committee of North Arts District Council on this Thursday, the 12th of October, at the time being 7:30. We'll go straight into the meeting. I have apologies this evening from Councillor Muir and Steers Hansford. And I have Councillor Stanley from the Surrey for Councillor Muir. Councillors, you've all been given the minutes of the meeting with the Planning Control held on the 14th of September. I hope you've had time to digest them. Are there any comments or may I take them as a report?
Thank you.
Thank you. I have no notification about the business. Members of the public and press may use their devices to film, photograph or do a sound recording of the meeting. But please raise your hand to let me know that you're doing this so that I can inform all the presses. Please do not use flash and disable any beams or other sound notifications that may emit from your device. In addition, can I remind all present that in line with council policy, this meeting is being audio recorded. Can speakers please wait until they have a microphone before speaking? And please could members, officers and public speakers announce their names each time they speak and speak directly into the microphones to assist the members of the public. It is particularly important that we do have the microphone fairly close to our faces and that we speak loudly and clearly so that everybody in the room can hear. Thank you. Members of the public have 5 minutes for each group of speakers, that is 5 minutes for objectors and 5 minutes for supporters. This 5 minute time limit also applies to member advocates. The bell will sound after 4.5 minutes of the warning and again 5 minutes to signify that the speaker must cease. I wish to advise members of the committee and members of the public about the process we will follow regarding the items about Langley Junction or Potter's Heath Road and Daisbury Park and Wellington. The committee will listen to the information and ask questions regarding item number 6. After which members of the press and public will be excluded and members will consider item number 11. Once consideration of item 11 is complete, members of the public and press will be invited to return to the room, at which time the committee will undertake any further part by the debate required and make a decision. Following completion of these items, there will be a 10-minute recess to allow members of the public to leave if they wish to do so. Members are reminded that any declarations of interest in respect of any business set out in the agenda should be declared as either a disclosable peculiar interest or declarable interest and are required to notify the chair of the nature of any interest declared at the commencement of the relevant item on the agenda. Excuse me. Members declaring a disclosable interest must withdraw from the meeting for the duration of the item. Members declaring a declarable interest, which requires they leave the room under paragraph 7.4 of the Code of Conduct, can speak on the item but must leave the room before the vote and the vote. There are a number of speakers this evening. I will introduce them as we get to them on the agenda items. And so we'll move on to the agenda. Page 1, which is to consider the land of the junction of Potter's Heath Road and Daisbury Park Road. And I'd like to introduce Simon Ellis, who will present this report and any updates. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman. We all know where this site is. There's the aerials. There's the site plan. I'll leave it at that. Members had before them a legal opinion submitted on behalf of Coldwell Parish Council and an appeal decision, which is associated with that legal opinion, and we were informed that that had been distributed to you by email in advance. However, we found out at 6 o'clock it hadn't been, so we've given hard copies to everyone. In any event, it's there. This legal opinion has been reviewed by the council's appointed barrister, who has provided a further written response. I have been advised by the council's corporate legal manager and monitoring officer that I cannot reveal the content of this further advice in part one. But copies will be distributed to members in part two of this meeting for their consideration. I can, however, confirm that our barrister strongly disagrees with the position of Coldwell parish council's barrister. Moving on to the summary. So as this is not a typical planning committee report and recommendation, and the decision members need to make is not to grant or refuse planning permission, rather than offering us the standard updates on matters arising, I will instead try to summarise the position for the benefit of members. Again, I must firstly confirm that you are not being asked to grant or refuse planning permission. You are being advised to revise the council's position in relation to the forthcoming appeal. As things stand, and regardless of the decision members reach this evening, the decision as to whether or not planning permission should be granted rests with the appointed planning inspector. So I now wish to set this in context. Firstly, as set out in paragraph 7.1 of the report. At the meeting of the Planning Control Committee held on the 17th of January 2017, members resolved to refuse planning permission for this development against the officer recommendation, which was to grant a temporary 3-year planning permission. Turning to paragraph 7.3. An appeal against this decision was received in March 2017. In appeal proceedings, the planning inspector have now decided which method of appeal they wish to use in order to enable the appointed planning inspector to reach a decision. In this case, the inspector has decided that the appeal must be considered by way of a public inquiry, not a hearing or a written representation method. The inquiry dates are set for 3 days, commencing on the 5th of December 2017. The purpose of a public inquiry is to enable all members, also all parties, to present evidence for their position and to allow that evidence to be scrutinised under cross-examination. Each party will need legal representation at the inquiry. As members will know from training and from experience, planning officers are unable, under their professional code of conduct, to present evidence on behalf of the council which is contrary to their professional view. As the officer view was that a temporary planning permission was justified in this case, this immediately rules out officers being able to present the committee's decision to refuse planning permission. In this case, however, we decided that the case was, as we considered it at the time, was marginal, and we therefore employed the services of a highly experienced planning consultant to be the council's expert professional witness at the inquiry. Philip Hughes is that expert, and he's sitting next to me today. The duty of each participant in the inquiry is to assist the appointed inspector in their decision. The exercise will not be about reviewing the basis of the decision that the committee reached in January 2017, but considering the issues in light of the most up-to-date evidence. Therefore, as well as appointing a planning consultant to seek to defend the committee's decision, officers sought more up-to-date evidence on the welfare of the current occupiers of the site by undertaking our own welfare assessment, and as part of the local plan process, commissioning a new Gypsy and Traveller accommodation assessment, which is attached as Appendix D to this report. The welfare assessment, and indeed the appellant's statement of case and need, revealed the number of children in the premises has now increased by one from the time that members refused planning permission for the development in January 2017. The welfare assessment was carried out on the 29th of June 2017 and has revealed that there are now 5 children residing in the premises, ranging in age from, at that time, 5 months old to 12 years old. The school-aged children attend local schools. This new information that members need to be aware of, which will need to be considered by the inspector, when the appeal is determined. The updated Gypsy and Traveller accommodation assessment conducted by the council's appointed consultants, Opinion Research Services, which will inform the forthcoming examination into the local plan, has concluded 2 matters of relevance to the appeal which also have a bearing on the inspector's forthcoming decision on the current appeal in relation to this case. The first conclusion is that, in their opinion, the current occupiers of this site do comply with the 2015 government definition of travellers. This definition is contained in the August 2015 government publication Planning Policy for Travellers Sites. defined as persons of a nomadic habit of life, whatever their race or origin, including such persons who, on grounds only of their own or their families or dependents' educational or health needs or old age, have ceased to travel temporarily, but excluding members of organised group of travelling show people or service people travelling together as such. That's the definition. The second conclusion is that in order to meet the needs of the travelling community within the planning period, when applying the assessment based on up-to-date definition of travellers, is now for an additional 10 pitches over the Gypsy Travel Accommodation Assessment Period, which is 2017 to 2032, not 7, as is shown in the current submission local plan policy HS7. And I refer members to page 69, paragraph 6.20, which sets this out. Whilst primarily this updated evidence will be for the examination in public, and the inspector who reviews the local plan evidence to consider, this new evidence will also be a factor that the inspector in relation to this appeal will want to examine. Moreover, this change in accommodation need for the travel community is another material change in circumstances that has taken place since January 2017, when members resolved to refuse planning permission for this development. Another change in circumstances set out in paragraph 8.4 is that the temporary planning permission for 5 pitches of Pullman Water has now elapsed. This, together with other factors, calls into question the feasibility of the alternative site that the council is currently putting forward to meet our identified need over the planned period. This is the playing field in which the public inquiry will be, and these are the issues that the council will be required to provide evidence to assist the inspector in reaching a decision as to whether to allow or dismiss this appeal. In light of this new evidence, Philip Hughes has advised me that he is professionally unable to defend a position of refusal of public inquiry. Of crucial significance in relation to this conclusion is an assessment of the best interests of the children who reside at this site, as is required under paragraph 16 of the August 2015 Planning Policy for Traveller Sites. This states, in relation to traveller sites in the Greenbelt, inappropriate development is harmful to the Greenbelt and should not be approved except in very special circumstances. Traveller sites, temporary or permanent, in the Greenbelt are inappropriate development. Subject to the best interests of the child, personal circumstances and unmet need are unlikely to clearly outweigh the harm to the Greenbelt and any other harm so as to establish very special circumstances. The equation here is, are the best interests of the children residing on the site best served by refusing planning permission? The consequences of which is to remove them from their current site and leaving open the question as to where they can live as part of the traveller community. In our view, and in the view of the planning consultant, this argument is compelling, and we do not consider that a position of refusal is sustainable at a public inquiry. I therefore recommend that members reconsider the council's position, given these changes in circumstances, and accept the officer's recommendation. The only alternative is for members themselves to present the evidence of the public inquiry. Before concluding this summary, I will ask Philip Hughes to give a brief explanation of his experience in these matters. Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you. I've had extensive experience appearing for and advising local planning authorities, parish councils, and local amenity groups and third parties in respect of inquiry and hearing appeals relating to Gypsy and Traveller sites for in excess of 20 years. My duty at any appeal as a chartered town planner is to assist the inspector in properly understanding the evidence and outlining my professional opinion in respect of the whole evidence as presented at that forum. In this case, members are in a position where the evidential base has moved on since they reached their decision. The application as submitted was, to be blunt, accompanied by scant information. However, since the appeal was submitted, a significantly enhanced amount of information has been submitted, in particular relating to the needs of the appellant and their personal circumstances. In that regard, members will be aware of the appeal statement and appended to it the witness statements of the occupants of the site. attached to those witness statements is also a list of previous sites occupied by the appellants who came to the site from the roadside. In addition, as part of the local plan process, as Simon's outlined, the council has itself updated its evidence base, including the Gypsy and Traveller accommodation assessment. The result of this review, as you've heard, is to increase the level of need over the plan period from 7 to 10 pitches. This level of need is significantly higher than had previously been anticipated and is currently planned for in the plan. Your emerging local plan, submitted in June 2017, understandably does not make provision for the full need of Gypsy and Traveller site provision over that period that has now been identified in the revised GTAA. Therefore, in order to meet the need over the plan period, permission will have to be granted outside the identified allocated sites. Indeed, the allocation would only make provision for the now unauthorised caravans at the Pulmer Water site and no one else. There is no doubt in my mind that the proposal causes harm to the Green Belt in terms of inappropriateness and loss of openness. It also offends the purpose of the Green Belt policy and leads to development that encroaches into the countryside. Your reason for refusal identifies inappropriateness and harm to openness, and members were entitled, in carrying out their planning balance, to conclude that the circumstances advanced in favour of the grant of permission at that time did not amount to very special circumstances and thus refuse permission. However, having considered the up-to-date position, this is no longer a position that I feel able to defend, given the personal circumstances of the occupants have evolved, and we now understand there to be 5 children at the appeal site. We also understand the local connections of the appellants and their circumstances more completely, as well as the circumstances of the children at site and their education needs. A refusal of planning permission will, in all likelihood, result in the occupants, including the children, having to resort to the roadside. And in that regard, we can be conscious of the fact that the applicants were moved on 12 times from the roadside before alighting on this site. The council has no alternative sites it can point to that these occupants could occupy, and currently have not identified adequate land for pitch provision for the planned period. The circumstances are materially different to those at the time of the application, and in that context, I cannot support the proposition that the best interests of the children on this site will be served by the refusal of planning permission. Thank you.
Thank you. We have Parish Councillor Alan Gregory of the Parish Council would like to address the committee as an objector.
Good evening, Mark.
Considering that a breach of planning regulations has taken place, there is an expectation that the matter will be dealt with appropriately. But you are now being asked to reverse the council's position and invite the appellants to submit a further planning application. You will be familiar with the grounds upon which you are recommended to overturn your earlier decision, but our barrister is clear that the reasoning set out in the report is flawed. In January, you considered that the best interests of the 4 children living on the site did not give rise to special circumstances outweighing the harm onto the Greenbelt. The material change in circumstances is outlined as 1 additional child and the health issues relating to a resident on the site. This does not demonstrate that planning permission will likely be granted on appeal. The mere presence of children on the site and their need for education and healthcare not automatically give rise to very special circumstances. The government's policy is clear on this. The report highlights that there is a shortfall in the numbers of gypsy and traveller accommodation identified in the proposed submission local plan, and erroneously suggests that a marginal increase in unmet need is a material change of circumstances that means the council is no longer contesting The planning committee was well aware that there was an unmet need when it made its decision to refuse planning permission in January. In 2013, this statement was issued by the government. The Secretary of State considers that the single issue of unmet demand is unlikely to outweigh harm to the Greenbelt to constitute the very special circumstances justifying inappropriate development in the Greenbelt. The officer's report also fails to refer to the August 2015 policy statement on Greenbelt protection and intentional unauthorised development. In the recent Rushett Stables decision, the inspector took into account the fact that there was an intentional unauthorised development, that there was a significant unmet need for travelling sites in the area that was unlikely to be met by the authority in the short term, and the personal circumstances and health issues of the applicant and the needs of his four children. The inspector in that case concluded that the harm caused by the development in the Greenbelt was not outweighed by the various factors which the appellant relied upon. And these factors are similar to those now relied upon by Mr. Connolly. You are also advised that if you elect to pursue this appeal, it is likely that the council will be found to have acted unreasonably, and that this will lead to an award of costs against the council. The guidance used to substantiate this assertion is out of date and has been superseded by the planning policy guidance. This states that local planning authorities are at risk of an awards cost if they behave unreasonably with respect to the matter under appeal. For example, by unreasonably refusing or failing to determine planning applications, or by unreasonably defending appeals. In the light of relevant government policy, it is far from inevitable that new circumstances identified will carry significant weight in favour of granting planning permission. Even if appeal was allowed and planning permission granted, this would not necessarily indicate that the council acted unreasonably in choosing to defend the appeal. So, legal matters aside, what do I want to convey to you? Firstly, that many of the issues you have had to weigh up with this planning application are superfluous. You may remember that the original planning statement outlined a family dispute that led the Connors to flee in fear from their previous home. But I'm pleased to inform you that the dispute is now settled. Very soon after the original application was refused, the families were seen back at their former home, and they have continued to spend much of their time there. Other gypsy and traveller sites within the parish of Codicote continue to flourish. The unmet need for pictures does not seem to be causing a huge problem. Adverts for accommodation are regularly seen in the local paper, and migrants from overseas, mainly Eastern Europe, travel to the site to live and work in family business. We're not entirely sure how these figures are balanced within the local plan, but an opportunity to talk this through with Mr. Ellis and the enforcement department would be welcome. And finally, and I know this is not a material planning consideration, but this might be my last chance to say it. A rural, leafy lane where most of the residents have lived quietly as neighbours for years. A neighbour. Someone who stops you in the street to ask after your health, or someone who stops the traffic in the street to threaten your health after you have spoken at a planning control committee meeting. I urge the committee to consider all parties in this matter and make a stand against this illegal and unnecessary encroachment into our Greenbelt. Thank you.
Thank you. If you could just hold for one moment, please. Members, you've heard the presentation. Do you have any questions or clarification of Councillor Gregory's presentation? Thank you very much. Now I'd like to invite Councillor Paul Gray and Councillor Steve Hemingway to address as advocates.
Just give a return to the original site, which, as you know, has has been subject to multiple applications for which it's been refused. It's really about sites not suitable for development. You came to a decision in January that you would refuse the temporary planning permission recommended by the officer, and obviously refused the permanent permission retrospectively applied for by the applicant. You're now being asked to accept that an additional child and an increase in demand of a handful of sites in the district over the planned period suddenly changes everything, and that you should now accept the recommendation to no longer defend this, or give your own decision arrived at by the proper process of deciding these applications and effectively concede. So the argument is that although you made a decision which was to refuse, it's in practice impossible to defend a decision at the public inquiry. You've heard an expert saying that indeed this is the case, that you don't really, you won't want to, the circumstances are such now that the case is not able to be defended. But you have before you it's all been considered. This is a marginal application. It was actually mentioned this evening by Simon Ellis that it's considered marginal. It's marginal, but on the other hand, it's so clear-cut that you should just follow and accept the application. So, as I said at the beginning, at the original application, I really think this is such a thorny application. It demands a planning inspector to rule on whether or not an application, this particular application, and implicitly a series of similar applications on adjacent sites should be allowed. Because I am very confident that if this is not defended, this will not be the last application of this nature in this area. It's really very unsatisfactory that you came to a decision and now you're being told that actually, you know, the council can't defend the decision. The objective group, the Prosthetic Association, have always assumed that when it comes to a public inquiry, because the council came to a proper decision, they would not have to go to the considerable expense of employing their own barrister and expert witness at the planning inquiry, and that they were recommended not to be at Rule 6 part of the inquiry. This is a significant expense for a small rural community. The council has much more resources, and this is an important issue that should be settled, as I said, at the public inquiry. The argument is that, the argument circuits centering on the lack of sites is that, we don't really have enough suitable sites in the district, but this particular site, opportunistically occupied by a particular family, is clearly the right site to meet the shortfall, and that the sort of carefully scrutinised process that we go through to select sites in the local plan for housing doesn't need to be followed in this stage. We just accept that this particular site where a couple of families moved into overnight is the right site going forward, effectively forever. You have before you the opinion of the barrister, and which clearly sets out many legal grounds and precedents for arguing this case is defensible, and that it's extremely unlikely that costs will be awarded against the council.
I absolutely endorse everything Councillor Hemingway said, everything Councillor Gregory said, and I hope members will have heard every single word of the advice from Mr. Pike. I should have said an awful lot more to you, but what Oyster Point says is, in my view, wholly correct, absolutely compelling, and really appeals. If you haven't had a chance to read it, I can't explain why it should be sent. It was sent earlier this week. It's lamentable it never sounds like it. I won't have to say anymore.
If you'd like to say comment, please. Councillors, do you have any questions of the presentation you just heard from the councillors? Thank you very much for the presentation. Now I'd like to invite Mr. Matthew Green, who is the appellant's agent.
Studio. We practice a couple of law in Wales, but one of our areas of specialism, as Mr. Hughes would know, because he and I have appeared opposite each other in quite a number of appeals, one area is gypsy and traveller. In fact, we do about 40% of all of the gypsy and traveller appeals in the country. In fact, I'm the principal witness for those. As Mr. Hughes will be able to confirm, I'm sure, when you go into private session, in Greenbelt cases, win in excess of 8 out of 10 of my appeals. And that is because I don't take an appeal unless I think there's a realistic prospect of success. This is an appeal I took. We didn't do the application, but Brown Associates did the application. We took over at the appeal stage. In particular, on this case, what I would like to point out, I think you've had a very fair assessment by Mr. Hughes as to what the harms in this case. They are all what we call the greenbelt harms, that is, impact by reason of inappropriateness, actual impact and openness, and probably encroachment as well, although you didn't mention that in your original refusal, something that we would both concur with. They are all greenbelt harms. What the Secretary of State, in a court case a year ago, in the case of beer, accepted was that meant that where children was involved, the Secretary of State would give substantial weight to those collective harms. What the Secretary of State in the case of Deere in the High Court has accepted is that in a Greenbelt case, the starting point for the best interest of the children, if it is identified that the best interest of the children is served by a grant of permission, which in this case would be the obvious one, there's no reason why it would not be the case, there's not a danger to the children on the site, which is where it might come from, that would not be the case. That the similar weight must be given to the best interest of the children. And that is something that Secretary of State, the current Secretary of State, has accepted in writing to the High Court. The starting point is substantial weight, i.e. the interests of the children alone balance out the harm in this case. Now, in the Greenbelt case, we have to clearly outweigh the combined harm, but there are other factors, the general need for gypsy and traveller sites, the lack of alternative sites, what we might call a failure of policy, that's an emotive phrase, the inability of your plan to completely meet the need that has now been identified, and indeed the fact that any sites you identify are likely to be in the Greenbelt. All of those are matters that would also add to this balancing exercise such that it clearly outweighs. Given the involvement of children, in the last 2 or 3 years since there was a hiatus, but we started getting gypsy and traveller decisions again in the spring of 2015, around the time of that general election then. Since then, I have not lost a case that has involved children in the Greenbelt. Gypsy and traveller cases in the Greenbelt I have lost have been where there have not been children involved in them. I'm sure Mr. Hughes would be able to confirm, he's probably aware of quite a lot of my cases. This is a case that if it continues to appeal, yes, I fully expect to win. One further thing I would add is that it is relatively rare, and I'll be quite frank, relatively rare in Greenbelt cases for costs to be awarded against councils. These are usually, and I say usually, matters of relatively fine balance, and you don't get usually costs against you. But I recently had full costs awarded in the case in South Gloucestershire. It's not actually in the appeal that we submitted because it actually postdates, the decision postdates what was submitted. And in that case, the reason for refusal by the local authority only involved greenbelt farms, almost identical. It was a single pit site rather than a two pit site. And there were children involved, and the inspector took the view that in the light of the current case law, which I can cite the Court of Appeal and Supreme Court cases as well that revolve around this, in the light of the current court cases, the council couldn't reasonably defend the situation where there was only, and I would say that in inverted commas, only greenbelt harm. So I would concur with the advice that you are being given that it is very likely that a grant of planning permission will result from a public inquiry, and it is also fairly likely in this instance that costs would be awarded against the council. Now clearly that's not the interest of the council, it's not actually the interest of my clients, they'd rather get permission before that. The person who's interested is that this goes to a public inquiry is myself, I'll earn more money. I'm here arguing against that, because I think that it would be in everyone else's interest for this not to go to a public inquiry. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. This one for a moment. Members, do you have any questions or clarification of Mr. Green's presentation? Councillor Bishop. Could you announce your name and your staff, please?
Hello. Councillor John Bishop. It's a comment really rather than a question. It's the first time I've seen somebody sit in that chair. I'm really not mentioning the planning merits or otherwise in the case, rather than simply trying to frighten us.
Thank you. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
I'd now like to invite someone else to respond to any issues which may have raised during the speakers' presentations. Let's join us.
We're going to respond to one point. First of all, you have this legal advice here, and it refers extensively to this appeal decision. It compares the appeal decision to your current situation. It doesn't contrast. I'm going to ask Philip Hughes just to point out a few differences between this appeal decision. There's the legal opinion and the appended appeal decision.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman, can I check? Councillor Paul Clark, this is the information we were given 7 minutes before the start of the meeting, which I find exceedingly unacceptable and unprofessional.
I'm afraid we were told that it had been distributed to you.
It wasn't.
Well, there you go. In any event, that's the appeal decision. That's the legal advice. The legal advice compares, it doesn't contrast. I'm going to ask Philip Hughes just to offer a few comments on the differences between the two situations, if I may.
Thank you. Members will be aware in the first instance that each application should be dealt with on its own merits. And it's rarely possible to contrast two decisions either way and come to the same conclusions and circumstances, particularly when one's looking at personal circumstances, almost never could be the same in two circumstances, in two cases. In particular, in this case, members will note that the appellant had moved from bricks and mortar, from a dwelling house where he resided with his family and his four children, who were in education at the time, to the site that was subject of the appeal decision. One of the results recorded in the decision of that change was actually a deterioration in the education of one of the children, and that of itself led to the inspector opining that the best interests of the child may not be served by the grant of planning permission at that site. He also comments on the aversion of the appellant and also separately of his family to residing in bricks and mortar in that case. Those are not circumstances that sit with the case we are looking at. We are looking at a site where the appellants had been roadside prior to occupation of this site. And in the appeal papers, members may be aware, is a schedule of 12 sites, roadside sites, previously occupied by the appellants, where they've received notices to vacate land prior to occupying this site. Again, that's a circumstance that doesn't sit on the face of it with the evidence that was presented in the case in Surrey that relied on. Of course, none of us sat here today can know the full gamut of the evidence that was before that inspector, but reading the decision, there are clearly differences between the two cases. There was an adopted core strategy date in 2012 in place in terms of the Surrey decision, and a GTAA that was dated back to 2008. The proposal was found by the inspector to comply with development plan policy in terms of their policy DM16. Again, those are circumstances that set apart that decision from this. I won't pretend to understand the full circumstances of that case, but I would just caution members that relying on other decisions on sites, particularly sites some distance away where we don't know the circumstances of the case, and this is a site in the Greenbelt, so it relates well in terms of those pure policy circumstances, but it's a site located next to a major developed site in Greenbelt. I think it's next to one of the major theme parks in that part of the country. So there are very clearly different considerations relating to both appeals, and I'm not sure that the conclusions of the inspector in the Surrey decision are transferable to this case. And in any case, I have carried out my assessment on the facts of this case and my experience of having dealt with appeal decisions, as I say, for an excess of 20 years on numerous sites nationwide. And certainly if I felt there was a case and I could defend members' position, I wouldn't be sat here today advising you otherwise. Thank you, members.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Are we live question?
Not at this stage. Thank you. I would like to just take up on the Councillor Clark's point. yes.
I can't hear you. It's not near enough the microphone.
Or maybe each of you.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry. You've heard these two pieces presented to you this evening. And I do appreciate the fact that they are late coming. What I would like to suggest to you and get your direction on, when we suspend the meeting for moving into part two, that we have a 15-minute recess for members of the public leave, which will give you time to discuss and look through these two yourselves. Are you happy with that? Okay, thank you. In which case we'll now go into the debate on part one so far. Councillor Bishop.
Councillor John Bishop. What are we debating here?
The motion before you is that basically the appeal has been made against the decision that this committee made earlier in the year, and in the light of new information which has been presented to this committee and through the council, it is suggested that the committee might like to reconsider its decision and not present a case to the appeal. Am I right? That's far.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Councillor Paul Clark. We're always told each case on its merit and the evidence we have at the time. On January the 18th, we had the evidence in front of us that we made our decision on. And Mr. Hughes, in his earliest discussion earlier, said that was a defendable position. This is now, has changed. New evidence has seemingly come to light. The local plan was submitted by this council in June. The revalidation of the sites was submitted in September. The permission for the temporary site in Caldicott fell in September. I'm confused why we are looking at new evidence. If the councillors acted irresponsibly on evidence we did not have at the time, I'm struggling to understand. This is all evidence, this appeal going forward is based on evidence that has come out since. Why are we being subjected to what we are doing? Perhaps the officers or Mr. Hughes would like to explain and help me understand the situation better.
Mr. Hughes.
Thank you, Chairman. The appeal has to be determined on the evidence available to the inspector at the date of the inquiry. And you're quite right, on the circumstances at the time members made their decision, I was comfortable that was a defensible decision. However, we have got the changes in circumstances, including the provision of much more information on the personal circumstances of the appellants, which wasn't available within the application. We have the changes in terms of the need position of the borough that has emerged as part of the plan process, and they are material circumstances the inspector is duty-bound to consider as part of his decision. It's also a duty of local authorities to review their decisions should circumstances change. And that is the context within which you're being asked to consider today's motion. Thank you.
Thank you. Councillor Mentor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm puzzled. I've always been told that planning applications relate to the site, not to the personal circumstances of the applicant. Is this something, or the applicant, is this something that is special to travellers, that we take the personal circumstances into account? And the second point, from what Mr. Hughes has just said, what are the actual changes in circumstances other than more information being available? I think there's a difference between the two.
Mr. Hughes, can you take this?
Yes. Dealing with the last point first, if I may, the personal circumstances provided with the application, well, I think I was blunt earlier, I said they were scant. There was very little information provided by the applicant at that time in support of their application detailing their personal circumstances. The council undertook a welfare assessment at that stage and managed to identify some of the circumstances of the appellant. Accompanying the appeal statement itself sets out a number of circumstances, but importantly, there are witness statements from both Mr. Patrick Connors and Mr. John Connors, the two heads of family, that detail the full circumstances of the family, including the education needs of the children and where they are educated at present. There is also, of course, the addition of another child since the application was determined, and also the information about the occupation of roadside sites prior to occupation of the appeal site. And in addition to all that, the council has undertaken another welfare review as well to update its information. That, in combination with the council's changed evidence base or evolved evidence base to support its local plan, where it has identified a greater level of need, and at present the evolving policy won't meet that full level of need, in combination, those circumstances are such that, in my view, I can't defend the council's decision in light of those changes. And as I said earlier, one has to review those decisions as evidence emerges up until the point of an inquiry being heard.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, I didn't have an answer to my first question.
Sorry.
Oh, I didn't know you had this part. Could you repeat the first part, please?
Yes, certainly. It was, why, when we're normally told that personal circumstances are not relevant to planning decisions, is that not the case in this instance?
Well, personal circumstances are capable of being a material planning consideration. They are not always relevant unless those circumstances are such that they tip the balance in terms of the material planning considerations. In a case of having a home or not having a home, a settled base and home, then the personal circumstances of that family, gypsy, traveller or otherwise, are capable of being a material planning consideration. The weight they attract is a matter for the decision maker, but they are capable of being material planning consideration. Rarely in most planning applications will they have very much weight, but in the circumstances of their home, in the context of other legislation, they are capable of carrying significant weight.
Thank you. Councillor Spencer Smith.
Yes, good evening, Mr. Hughes. Do you have any comments or observations on what we heard?
Could you speak up?
Do you have any comments or observations on what we heard from Elaine Gregory of Covent Hotel, actually not Policy Visitor Association, that the appellants have been observed living on the site from which they left several months ago, 12 months ago?
I'm not sure the inference was that they were living on the site. I think the inference was that they were returning to visit on the site. As I heard it, I may have that wrong. My understanding is they're living on this site, and certainly when I visited the site and area, they would appear to have been residents.
Okay. Councillor Booth, then Councillor Lewis. Can you pass the microphone to Councillor Booth, please? There should be one on each table.
Sure there is. I'm Councillor John Booth. I must admit, I was not involved in the January decision because I was not on the committee then. So this is new to me. It makes me rather sad. And there's one particular piece paper that highlights our problem. And it's on page 17, appendix A to the original report. And it says the local planning authority has to advance the quality of opportunity between persons who share an open protected characteristic and persons who do not share that characteristic, and foster good relations between persons who share a relevant protected characteristic and persons who do not. Unfortunately, in this particular case, I think our local planning committee, whichever decision we make, is not going to foster good relations. So, that is very sad. What I would like to ask is, at the January meeting, would members of the committee have been aware, or should they have been aware, that if they refused permission here, there was nowhere for those two families to go?
I think I can probably answer that. The information was placed before in the full officer's report, and consideration is made on that. Every consideration is taken from the report and the decision made on the strength of that. Councillor Lewis.
Thank you, Councillor Lewis. Could Mr. Ennis clarify something for me, please, from a planning point of view? Could he advise me where in the MPPF it says anything about the personal circumstances of somebody applying for planning permission?
I don't think you'll find reference to personal circumstances in the MPPF. But what you'll find a reference to in the Greenbelt context is very special circumstances. As you know from dealing with planning applications in Greenbelt on a regular basis, you only grant planning permission for an appropriate development when there are very special circumstances. The advice that Philip Hughes has given you, and the advice which I also agree with, is that personal circumstances can amount to very special circumstances in a Greenbelt context. but you won't find any particular reference to very special, to personal circumstances in the MPPF. It's a much broader document than that. If you look at other policy advice, the Gypsy and Traveller policy document, this one here, it does refer to the best interests of the child and personal circumstances. So there is policy guidance out there. It isn't contained in the MPPF specifically, but in the rounding and planning law on that basis, personal circumstances are a material consideration. It certainly will be able to deal.
Thank you. I'm going to allow supplementary from Paul Clark, and then Councillor Bishop. Councillor Bishop, you do have a microphone in front of you. Would you like to share it on the table and it becomes necessary? Thank you. Councillor Clark.
Thank you, Councillor Paul Clark. I'm glad you got your message across. The microphones. Two things. One, based on the evidence we have before us, this committee made a decision. Therefore, other evidence has come to light since. Is the council within its right to seek costs for the extra work that has been envisaged by the extra evidence that has now been put forward? One question. Second question, the applicant's consultant suggested that he had a letter, or has a letter, from the minister saying special circumstances for children is something that should be considered. Mr. Hughes, in his earlier statement, said it didn't outweigh. Could he clarify the position, please?
Yeah, I think I'm probably asking to just answer the second part. I think democracy comes with a cost. Cheers.
Sorry, just dealing with the issue of the information that's come forward as part of the appeal. I'm not advising you that solely on the basis of the new information contained within the appeal, that of itself is enough to change my opinion. It's a combination of factors that include the work that we've done as a local authority in terms of assessing need. In terms of applying for costs against any party at an appeal, one first has to demonstrate unreasonable behaviour. Then one has to link that to causation in terms of costs. I think given the combination of factors, it is unlikely in my view that the changes amount to unreasonable behaviour that is solely capable of being put at the appellant's feet. It is a combination of factors that have led to a change in circumstances. So I think it's a matter we would have to consider, but my initial thought is that there is probably unlikely to be a case, and it is within an appellant's rights and indeed the duties of any consultant acting for the appellant to respond to the case that's been put in terms of the reasons for refusal. How reasonable that is in terms of what's being put forward is a matter of different judgment to what we're trying to discuss this evening, and is a matter we'd have to give some thought to elsewhere. And I apologise in answering that rather long-windedly. I've forgotten the first element.
Yep. Councillor Paul Clark, the second part was to do with the letter from the minister, where it's you said that it wasn't a major consideration of welfare of the children, but in relation to the Greenbelt, but the consultant for the applicant said he had a letter from the minister stating that it does.
I apologise if I misled members. I certainly didn't intend to suggest that the best interest of the children is not a major consideration. It must be a primary consideration in any decision made by the state or indeed any public body. It must be the first element of any decision you make in planning the best interest of the child. It's not necessarily going to be the determining factor, but it must be the primary consideration. That's settled law in terms of the position. The statement, I think, is referred to in terms of the But the statement is from the PPTS, where it sets out the best interests of the child in the context of planning decisions on gypsy and travel sites, the planning policy for travel sites documents. But it's based on settled law in terms of those considerations.
Thank you. Councillor Bishop, and then I'm going to go into part two.
So we're not voting on it?
No, we're not voting on it.
I think we're being put between a rock and a hard place here. Should this committee decide to go to appeal, am I right in believing that this council is not going to support any of the committee members at that appeal?
Mr.
Let me just roll that back a little bit. As I said at the very beginning, regardless of, as things stand, regardless of your decision this evening, there will still be an appeal. The situation is that if you were to support the officer recommendation, Philip Hughes, together with our barrister, would represent the council at the appeal. However, at that appeal, Philip Hughes would be giving evidence that, in his professional opinion, he thinks the planning permission should be granted. The decision on the appeal would still rest with the inspector, so that at the very beginning, you're not being asked to grant planning permission, you're being asked to enable a professional expert and a councillor to present evidence at the appeal to say that, in the council's opinion, in light of changing circumstances and having reviewed all the issues, the council has reconsidered its position and now considers the planning permission should be granted. In the event that you do not agree with the officer's recommendation, we go back to the first principles when I advise you on a monthly basis. If you go against that professional advice, then the members themselves will have to present the evidence at the appeal and be cross-examined by the appellant's barrister. That's a normal part of the planning system, I'm afraid. Professional planners are not able to give evidence against their professional judgment. It will be exposed immediately. If myself or Tom Ray was sat at a public inquiry and the first question was, did you write that report in January 2017? And Mr. Ray said, yes, I did. Do you agree with it? Yes, I do. That's the end of the cross-examination, isn't it? So it doesn't practically work, let alone professionally work. So yeah, that is, in this sense, the rock and the hard place that you refer to, I'm afraid.
Thank you, Mr. Rose. I think we've reached a point now where we'll have a recess. We'll go into part two and then we'll go to be back further. And so I'll move on now to item number 10, which is the exclusion of press and public. And I'd like to consider the resolution that under section 108/4 of the Local Government Act 1972, the public and press be excluded from the meeting for the following item of business on the grounds that it involves the likely disclosure of exempt information as defined in paragraph 5 of part 1 of schedule 12A of the said Act. Are you in favour?
Indicate
the cards, please. Thank you very much.